Good afternoon, Columbus. You are listening to Columbus's only community radio station, WCRS LPFM. I'm Carlotta, a station volunteer, and today I'm in the studio with Florence Reed of Sustainable Harvest International, a nonprofit with a mission to provide farming families in Central America with the training and tools to preserve our planet's tropical forest while overcoming poverty. Ohio Wesleyan University Associate Professor of Fine Arts Jeff Nyland is joining us. Sustainable Harvest International and Ohio Wesleyan University recently worked together on a media project documenting the lives of some of the women Sustainable Harvest International works with in Panama. An exhibit featuring the photos taken on the trip opens tomorrow, April 12th, at Ohio Wesleyan's Gallery 2001 in the Beegley Library on the Ohio Wesleyan campus. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And did I say that correctly, the name of the library?
Yeah, Beegley.
It's Beegley. Okay. Uh-huh. Flo, I wanted you to begin by telling us more about Sustainable Harvest International, just so all of our listeners can understand what's going on with the organization and what you do.
Okay, sure. I'd be glad to. Basically, Sustainable Harvest International has one primary program that we do, which is a sustainable farming extension program. So we hire local field trainers or extension agents in each of the countries where we work. We work in Honduras, Belize, Nicaragua, and Panama. Mm-hmm. And each of our field trainers works with an average of about 40 families who have asked to work with us. And they visit those families every week or two for about 5 years and provide them with hands-on technical assistance to teach the families how to move away from slash-and-burn farming, which forces them to clear more rainforest every year, and to instead use sustainable farming practices that allow them to grow on the same land year after year without having to clear more of the forest. And the program is set up in 5 phases so that after the initial planning phase, the families can focus on learning sustainable ways of increasing production of their traditional staple crops. So they learn how to do things like make compost and use compost, use cover crops, do crop rotation. These types of techniques allow them to double, triple, quadruple, or better the production of their traditional staple crops and do so on the same land every year without having to cut down more of the rainforest. And then from there, they build on that by learning to diversify their crops with things like organic vegetable gardens so they can have a more balanced diet and produce a balanced diet for themselves so that even if there's no money, the family can always at least have a good diet and take care of that for themselves. And the last stage of work that we do with the families before they graduate from the program is focused on income generation and helping them add still more crops, diversify more, improve their production more so that they'll also have some farm products that they can sell. The families, when they start working with us, have an income of only a few hundred dollars a year. But by going through our whole program, they're able to increase that as much as tenfold so that they also are able to meet their other basic needs with the improved income. And so that's the focus of Sustainable Harvest's work. And then we have a complementary program, which is our Smaller World program, which takes groups of volunteers from the U.S. Usually to visit the communities where we work, get to know the families, get to see the projects that they're doing, and to do some volunteer work with us. And usually the volunteer work is more focused on things like helping to plant trees or set up raised beds for vegetable gardens, but sometimes we'll have a special group doing a specific type of volunteer work for us. And so that was the case with the Ohio Wesleyan group, where they were helping us to document our work with photographs and to focus on the women working with our program, which we haven't done very much in the past. So it was a wonderful collaboration from our perspective, and I'm very excited to see the photos now.
I want to back up a little bit and ask you about starting the organization, because I'm really interested in why you chose Central America, and then what types of practices you're teaching the farmers.
Okay, sure. Well, I started Sustainable Harvest International based in great part on my experience as a Peace Corps volunteer. I was in the Peace Corps in Panama in the early 90s, and I lived in a small rural community, farming community in Panama. And during the 2 years or so that I was there, I got to really see firsthand a lot of what I had learned as a college student about the loss of tropical forests. I saw how the farmers were cutting down the forest and burning the forest every year to grow their crops because their traditional slash-and-burn style of agriculture forces them to burn more of the forest every year. And I saw how that was degrading the land and how it was making it harder and harder for them to sustain themselves on the land, and how it was getting to the point where many of them were having to leave the community because they couldn't sustain themselves anymore. And so they were either picking up and going to where there's virgin forest to start the process over again there, or often going into national parks and starting to burn the forest in the national parks to grow their crops, or they were moving into the city to try to look for work. But since many of them have maybe only a third grade education, they ended up living and working in really horrible conditions in the cities. And so they were really desperate to find an alternative that would allow them to stay in their communities, produce enough for their families on the land that they had, and not have to keep clearing the forest or abandon their communities. And so I came out of Peace Corps really wanting to work for an organization that was focused on providing the farmers with the kind of long-term technical assistance that they needed to make that transition. And I was really shocked to find there was no such organization in existence.
And it's, I'm sorry, is that the work kind of work you were doing in Peace Corps was that kind of technical assistance?
Yes. In Peace Corps, I was supposed to be doing environmental education, but our Peace Corps group was the first to go back to Panama in 20 years, and they weren't quite ready for us when we got there. So our environmental education group of volunteers was told that we didn't have permission to work in the schools yet, so we should just go out to our villages, try to be useful, and come back in 3 months for our hepatitis shot and see if anything had changed. Mm-hmm. So I sort of had to just see what would happen. And when I got to the community, most of the community was there waiting for me to greet me. And they had a whole sort of ceremony to welcome me, and everybody made speeches. And then it came time for me to make my speech. And I said, well, hello, I'm Florencia, and here's what I studied in college, and here's some of my experiences, and I'll be here for 2 years, and if you know how I can be useful, let me know.
Yeah.
And the people all came to me and said, well, we'd really like it if you could help us plant trees back onto our land and help bring life back to our land. So I spent most of my time in Peace Corps on reforestation projects, helping community groups to set up tree nurseries and grow seedlings and then transplant the tree seedlings out onto their farms and onto community land. And that went really well. We planted thousands of trees, had tremendous success with that. But towards the end of my Peace Corps service, I realized that all of these trees we were planting were probably going to be cut down and burned again if the same farming techniques continue to be
burn.
Right. If families kept using slash and burn.
And what does that mean?
Well, it's more or less what it sounds like. It's a traditional type of farming where a farmer will cut down an area of forest and then burn it. And the ash that's created acts like a natural fertilizer, or it is a natural fertilizer, and they can grow their crops for maybe a year. But then the heavy rains and the rainy season wash away the ash, wash away the soil. And then, the farmers have to pick up and move to a new area of forest, cut that, burn that, and so on. And I think it was probably a good farming system when it was a small indigenous population and they could leave a cleared area to recuperate for 100 years surrounded by virgin forest. But now the population's much larger. The land is not distributed equitably. The wealthy people have most of the best land. The poor farmers that work with us are farming on steep hillsides. So for a variety of reasons, it's a terrible farming system now, even though it may have been a good one at one time. And now the farmers have to go back after, instead of 100 years, after maybe 5 or 6 years.
Okay.
And whatever's grown back, cut it down again and burn it again. And so the land never recuperates. And each time they repeat the cycle, it's more and more degraded. Sometimes they can stretch it out a little bit longer by using chemical fertilizers, but that uses most of their income and has other environmental impacts that we'd rather not see. So what we do is teach the families how to build up the soil using the resources they have at hand and using natural techniques. So as I said, things like how to make compost and use compost for growing their crops, how to use cover crops, things like what we call fertilizer beans that aren't planted as beans for eating, but they produce a lot of organic material. And they can be used as a cover crop to keep the weeds down and then to produce all this organic material with a lot of nitrogen in it and other nutrients. And then when they're cut back and they decompose, it puts all those nutrients into the soil, builds up the soil, and helps the crops to continue growing. And if you combine that with other techniques, such as erosion barriers to stop the soil from washing down the hillside, things like crop rotation, things like integrated pest management, finding natural ways to control pests from harming the crops. When you combine all of these different techniques, it allows the farmers to dramatically increase the production of their crops and to grow on the same land every year instead of having to clear more each year like they would with the slash and burn farming.
Okay. So in 1997, I had interrupted you. You found that there were no organizations to do what you wanted to do.
Right. Well, when I got out of the Peace Corps in 93, I found that there were no organizations focused on providing this long-term technical assistance to farmers that I saw that they were anxious for and that they needed if we were ever going to preserve what was left of the world's tropical forests. And at that time and still today, the forests were being lost at a rate of over 1 acre every second. So we've already lost over half of the world's tropical forests. The rest is going very fast. And I just see no way to save what's left of it if the farmers don't have an alternative way to feed their children. Because if I had no other way to feed my child, I'd burn down the forest in the national park too. Mm-hmm. So I came out wanting to work for an organization focused on providing this alternative and was really shocked to find that there was no such organization in existence. And I didn't feel ready to start a brand new nonprofit straight out of Peace Corps. So first I went and worked for another nonprofit organization that had a very different mission from what I was interested in, but they were very well run. I learned a lot about how a well-run nonprofit operates. I learned a lot about fundraising, which is really important if you want to start a new nonprofit organization. And then from there, I went to another nonprofit organization that had a mission much closer to what I wanted to do, but was a horribly run organization. It was pretty much a sham. But I'm grateful for that experience, too, because I learned a lot about what I wanted to avoid in starting my own nonprofit. And in a strange twist of fate, it did lead me directly into starting Sustainable Harvest when they were dropping any work that they had said they might actually do towards their mission. And so that was the day that I quit that job and told myself I'd give myself one day to figure out how to start a new nonprofit to actually get this work done. Mm-hmm. And I said, all right, you can have one day. And if you can't figure it out in one day, then you need to throw the idealism out the window and get a real job.
Were you in Panama?
No, I was in the U.S. at that time.
Okay.
And so that one day that I gave myself, the problem I came up against was that I had no money. But I got an email that same day from a man that I had met on my last trip to Panama, a man from Switzerland. Never thought I'd see him again. Mm-hmm. And I just showed him some of the work that I'd been involved with. But he emailed, asked what was happening, and I told him. And he said, well, open a bank account, and I'll wire you some money so you can start your new nonprofit. And the next day, there was $6,000 in the account. And I sent half of it to Honduras to keep the guys I'd started working with there going. And the other half got us incorporated and got our tax-exempt status and got the first letterhead printed. And it's been little by little growing from there.
And so here we are tomorrow having an opening at Ohio Wesleyan. Jeff, can you talk about the project?
So Paula Travis had gone to Nicaragua, and like I said, she was mostly interacting with men. And she was really curious about the women that were there, but felt like the trip just didn't afford the potential or possibility or time to really interact with them and to get to know them. So since that trip, she really was, she had a desire to go back to Central America and to get to know the women there. So she approached me, a year ago last December, and asked if I'd be interested in taking photography students there and to do a kind of photography documentary experience. And I thought that sounded really interesting, in particular the idea that we would actually give the women cameras to use for themselves and that they would document their own lives with the cameras. And I thought that was particularly interesting. I think that in documentary work, oftentimes there's a detachment between the subject or the people that the photographers go to interact with. And so by giving them a voice or giving them a camera, then they're a part of the project, part of the their own documentation. So that was the part of it that that I really thought was exciting and got me interested in the idea.
Is that the kind of work you do? Are you a
I do, to an extent. I do sort of what would fit in with documentary photography, but it's typically with family and people that I know and places that I'm familiar with. So the idea of going into a new culture, a new environment, and working with people that I don't know and have only met just briefly, it was a real challenge, you know, the idea of doing that. And this is something that in my classes we talk a lot about. You know, we look at work, documentary work, photojournalistic work, and we talk about that idea. How do you go into a community and just right away start making work that's somehow meaningful or somehow has something to say about the people that you're photographing? And I think that that's a real challenge. And I have to say, I was a bit nervous, you know, how am I going to do this? Because in my own work, I'm a bit more cautious. I'm a bit more tentative. I get to know the people before I'm photographing them. I like to be invited and for the people to know that, to have a relationship before I start making photographs. And so I knew that this would be a challenge in the sense that we're just there for about a week, a little over a week. But what I found, partly because we were working with SHI and Flo knew many of the people or most of the all of the families that we were working with, that they were really ready for us to come. And so it really was like we were invited into their homes, and they were very eager to interact with us and to be a part of the program and the project. So there really were no issues with that. So,
Flo, why were you excited about this project?
Well, I was excited about this project in part for the same reason that Paula was, because when I visit our work in Central America, I also find that I spend a lot more time talking with the men in the communities and the families, and they're wonderful people, but I have been missing part of the story, I think, by not having a time to focus on the women and the impact that our work has on their lives.
Are they not farming, the women?
Generally, the men do the bulk of the farming, and the women will work with us to some degree, particularly with vegetable gardens near the home. We do some projects that are particularly geared towards helping them. Probably the most popular one are wood-conserving stoves that we help the women to build in their homes, because the women traditionally cook over an open fire, and that fills the house with smoke, and it's not very efficient. It uses a lot of firewood. And so we help them to build a simple wood-conserving stove that uses about a quarter the firewood of the traditional open fire. And it also has either a chimney or a secondary combustion process to eliminate the smoke. And so that takes care of the health problems that the women would have otherwise. When the women cook over the open fire, they're breathing the equivalent of 5 packs of cigarettes a day worth of smoke. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the women die young from complications from smoke inhalation. Wow. So they really benefit from a project like that mm-hmm. we do with the families. They often benefit from our work with them on the vegetable gardens. But the bulk of the work, the more extensive farming work, is usually done by men, not always, but usually. So for that reason, I usually end up spending more time talking with men when I visit the communities where we work. And this time we had the chance to focus on the women. And so I heard new things that I hadn't heard before in talking about what the benefits of Sustainable Harvest Program is. So some of the unintended consequences of our work that I might not have thought of. For instance, when we were interviewing a group of women and we were asking them if they'd seen any change in their lives since they started working with us, and one of the women said, "Well, my mental health has improved." And that was something I'd never anticipated hearing as a result of our farming work. And then she went on and explained that previous to working with us, really her whole life was pretty much housework. And she said there really wasn't much else in her life. And now she's got this organic garden and she's got a fruit tree orchard. And she said now she wakes up every morning excited to get up and go and see what new is happening in the garden and what there is to do. Her grandchildren come and help her. Mm. And she feels like her life has more meaning now and she doesn't feel depressed anymore. And as she was saying this, I saw a lot of the other women nodding their heads. And so it was something that I hadn't really thought about. Or another woman that we visited, Migdalia, she talked about how the work had been very hard working with us in the beginning, learning the new techniques, and that she'd almost quit. And then when my colleague asked her, well, why didn't you quit if it was so hard? She said, well, it was for my children, because the doctor told me that the reason my older children kept getting sick was because of the agrochemicals that we were using on our farm, and I didn't want them to get sick anymore. And so I stuck with it, and now it's easier because now I've gotten used to these new techniques, and I've learned a lot. I understand how those chemicals were affecting everything from the microorganisms in the soil to my children. And now my older children are healthier, and I've seen a difference with my younger child because she had a baby after she'd begun working with Sustainable Harvest. And she said her first two children were all born underweight, between 5 and 6 pounds. It was because she was malnourished, because the family wasn't able to produce enough food to feed themselves well. But when her little daughter Yasmin was born, Yasmin was almost 8 pounds. Mm-hmm. So there was a difference that she had seen that I often, I don't hear about those impacts of the work when I'm talking to the men so much. And she said that also with Yasmin, she was able to produce enough breast milk to feed her, which she hadn't been able to do with her first children, again, because she had been too malnourished. And so these sorts of things that talking with the men, they might not share those impacts of the work with us, I got to hear about on this trip. And so I loved hearing those stories, and I love spending the time with the students and the faculty, and getting to maybe see some of the work through their eyes, and see how they worked with the women on getting the photographs, teaching them how to use the cameras, and it was just a great trip.
Jeff, can you tell us more about what you and the students actually did once you got there? How did the project unfold?
Yeah. Well, the first stage was to meet with the women and then to interview them, so to get to know them that way. And we would we broke up into groups, so we each met with there were six of us. We broke into two groups, and we each met with a number of women, interviewed them, and then we showed them how to use the cameras, the basic digital cameras, they had the camera for a week, and we returned and took portraits of the women and then gathered the cameras. And during the portrait session, it was really interesting because many of the women lived, I mean, these are remote places, remote farms, so it was amazing to go from basically to drive as far as we could get in the van into a sort of central town. And then to hike, one of the farms was about 2 hours away from where we parked the van, and just beautiful forest. And it was amazing because the women we were hiking with, they had no problems. I mean, it was hot, it was humid, everybody's just dripping sweat.
When was the trip?
It was in August.
Okay.
So, but it was remarkable how just fluidly they moved through that landscape and seemed to have no problems, and would just be kind of giggling at us, you know, trying to cross the streams and carry all our camera gear, and they just had no problems with it. But so then we made portraits of the women, came back from the trip, and started the editing process. So I was looking through all the work that we shot, looking through all the images that they shot, which was for me the most fascinating part, just seeing the photographs that they made. You know, they had the cameras for about a week. They photographed day and night. They photographed intimate moments, just all kinds of things that we just would not have had access to. And that was really interesting. And so we edited down our portraits, so that we each, in the show, we have 21 portraits, so there are 21 women represented, and there were 6 of us total, and so people either have 3 portraits or 4 portraits, depending, and then each woman has about 6 or so photographs that is also in the show.
And what about the interviews? Are those implemented in the show at all?
Yeah, the interviews are in the show as well. An excerpt from that. So we have a page. There's the photograph, and then just to the right of the portrait is an excerpt from the interview, sort of statement, and it's in English and Spanish. And then to the right of that are their photographs.
Were all of your students Spanish-speaking?
Actually, no. We had one student who was supposed to go, and she was Spanish-speaking, but at the last minute had to back out of the trip. So really, really, we were all sort of beginning-level Spanish speakers. And so thankfully, we were with Flo and then a couple other people from SHI. There was another volunteer down there from, I think she was Peace Corps, maybe.
Have a Peace Corps volunteer working with us in Panama, but I think she might have been volunteering through a different program, possibly.
So she helped
you with the interviews.
Yeah, okay. We made it work. But that was definitely a challenging part of the trip. I think we all came back thinking, we're going to learn Spanish. No, I did. That was a really interesting part, to have to try to communicate.
Flo, how do you expect or hope this project, this exhibit, because I know it's going to go on the road after this, correct?
That is our hope, yes.
That's your hope. So how do you hope, though, that it impacts the work that you do?
Well, we hope that it just raises people's awareness about the issues that are being faced by the families in Central America and the work that they're doing to make the planet healthier for all of us. So that's our most basic hope for it, which I'm certain that it will do. Beyond that, I also hope it will bring more support for our work because at this point, we are working with about 850 families. We have another 650 who have graduated from our program, but we have thousands more that have asked to work with us and are waiting to work with us. There are 2 billion rural poor who are living on less than $2 a day who could benefit from this type of assistance.
Just in Central America? Or
well, around the world. Yeah, the 2 billion figures around the world. At any rate, my point is the demand is very large for the service that we offer through our program. And the one thing that's holding us back is really financial resources so that we can hire more field trainers to work with more families. So that we're hoping that some of the people who see the exhibit will be inspired to find a way to support our work and allow us to reach more families.
How do you... I don't know what question I'm... How do you think that people outside of Central America think about the work that you do in terms of its importance?
People outside of Central America?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think a lot of people really like the fact that we combine both poverty alleviation with environmental conservation, and it's not a trade-off. We're not sacrificing the environment for human beings or vice versa. We're helping people to get out of poverty, and at the same time we're helping to improve the environment. So I think that's very compelling to people. They see the impact that it has on the lives of the families that work with us, so that's compelling for a lot of them. For others, it's more the environmental aspect of our work. The families working with us have recently planted their 3 millionth tree, and so those 3 million trees are producing oxygen for all of us. They're stabilizing the climate for all of us, although it didn't feel like it this spring, but it's helping. Having a lot of other positive impacts on the planet that is a benefit for all of us. So I think people in this country think about it in those terms. I know that now when I'm looking for inspiration to keep working hard and doing my job and doing my best for the organization, I think about my son and how much I'd like him to grow up first on a planet that will continue to sustain human life, which in a lot of ways we're headed away from, I'm afraid. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, I also would like him to live in a world where everybody can meet their basic needs, because I think that we're all poorer for it when there are people in our world that can't meet their basic needs. And so I think that it's the same type of feeling that inspires other people to support our work.
Okay. The exhibit opens tomorrow. At what time does it open? 4 p.m.
Yeah,
is the
4 p.m.
program? What can we expect at the program, Jeff?
Well, Paula Travis will start out with giving a little background to the program and talking about how she initiated that and brought me into it. And then Flo will speak for a little while as well. And then the opening's from 4 to 6, and people can look at the photographs. All of the students who took part in the trip will be there as well. So we would love to talk to people about our experience.
The name of the exhibit is In Sight and Mind, a Photographic Collaboration with Women of Rural Panama. Florence Reed and Jeff Ninen, thank you for being here. This is WCRS LPFM. I'm Carlotta, a station volunteer, and today I was talking with Florence Reed of Sustainable Harvest International and Jeff Ninen, Associate Professor of Fine Arts from Ohio Wesleyan University. Thanks for listening.